Hello, it's Angela Walsh. Welcome to the Downhill Slide. It's been a while since I've uploaded any interviews for this podcast. My apologies. Double shifts, no time, life getting in the way. This interview was one I recorded with Irish Mick and Welsh Tony last year. And I wanted to talk to them because they just had such an interesting upbringing. They had to learn to live off the land. It was just a different time, but maybe we're going back to that time. Hello, Mick.
Hello, Angela.
And we have Tony.
Hello. Hi, Angela. How are you?
Thank you for coming in today. Now, Mick, you've got your little bit of Guinness there. And you, oh, Tony, you brought your own whiskey.
I have, but it's not Welsh.
Ah, so what is it? Well, I should have actually said that. We've got an Irishman and a Welshman.
But it's a good one.
So the whiskey you brought is not a Welsh whiskey. I didn't even know the Welsh made whiskey. Is that rude of me to say that?
We have one company that makes a Welsh whiskey in South Wales.
What's it called?
It is called, it'll come to me in a minute. It's a good question. Michael?
I don't know. I only drink Irish. The Irish distillery, Bushmills, is the oldest in the world, really, and still comes out of the mountain, the water. Irish whiskey is distilled three times. That's why it's so smooth.
Oh, okay.
And Bushmills has been there since the 1600s, and the old water wheel is still there, bringing the water in. They still make the whiskey the same way.
So do you have a favourite, Tony, favourite? Or is it just the whiskey? You don't care where it comes from as long as it tastes right.
No. I do like a heavy malt whiskey, you know, sort of. But I do like the Australian whiskies as well. I think Tasmania's got great prospects, and they're doing very well. So, you know, it's a young industry, but it's going to go places.
Well, to have you two here is quite funny because it's almost a joke. We've got an Irishman, a Welshman, and an Aussie walk into a studio. But what I asked you here today to talk about is the fact that you guys have quite a difference in age, but when you were kids, you lived in a similar way, as in living off the land, living in houses that didn't quite have the luxuries that we have today, such as electricity. You had running water, did you?
No, we didn't. I didn't.
Oh!
Well, I never had running water either.
You had, Mick, you had running
water. We had running water because we pumped up out of the well with a little steam pump. So it pumped it up out of the well into a holding tank. And then the water was run into the house. And we had hot water because it came in. We had a big fire in there with about six grits on it, you know, for cooking on. And that it had a wetback on, so you had the warm water all the time. And that water then went to the bathrooms, yeah. The old farmhouse was 300 year old. Still there.
It's still there now?
Oh, well, I go back. I was back there. I was going to say last year. It was the year before in July. The last time I was back, I went in the winter. I thought, I'll never do this again. Yeah. Brought back all the memories.
So is your family, do you still have family in that house?
Yeah, I've got my cousins lease it, and they run the farm. They got a piggery on it, and they pay the rent on that. I'm executor of the property, so the money goes in to the property account for maintenance and all that sort of stuff, and pays the taxes on it and what have you. Yeah.
So has that been in your family for all that time? Or
it was in my mother's family and my father's family were the fishing people. And originally they came from northern Scotland, a place called Wick. And Port of Ferry, where they ran the trawlers out of, which they still do, they pulled in there. It was a safe harbor. And he met my great-great-grandmother, and her name was McKenna. And they got married and stayed there. But what you got to remember was one side was Catholic and the other side was Protestant. My father's people were Presbyterians. And then when my father met my mother, she was very Catholic. The Crones are very Catholic. Three priests and the nuns and all.
In the family.
Well, yeah, and the two other boys were killed in the First World War. But they got married. But I used to think when I went to school, my dad hated me. I went to a Christian Brothers school, we were called the half and halves.
Ooh.
And they, like the brothers hadn't got a lot of time for you're a half and half. I can remember going to the dances when you were about 17, yeah? Small country town, not much bigger than Barham. And the Catholic girls wouldn't dance with you. And the Protestant girls wouldn't dance with you. So you had to look around for somebody. You knew all who the half and halfers were.
That's interesting. I didn't know religion had such
And Northern Ireland religion plays a big part in everything, you know?
But just so close in a school, I wouldn't imagine.
That's the way it is. Just the way it was. They were, they called them mixed marriages, frowned upon by priests and ministers of all.
Yeah.
So I never had any girlfriends. And
well, you ended up getting married and having children.
That was a chance thing. But I used to go, like I was pretty fit. My thing was swimming and rock climbing, so, and shooting. So my mate Delaney and Brophy, we used to go hunting for Spanish treasure off the west coast of Ireland, where Drake, the Spanish Armada, you know, sunk. We never found anything, but you were still hunting for it, you know. Found lots of bottles, maybe from the, as you went off, you could only go out a couple of hundred meters and then it dropped away very deep. But the Atlantic line, the American Atlantic liners coming in, probably people up on top drinking and throwing the bottles over. But I thought about it later. The bottles were probably worth off a lot of money off, you know, the big liners that were there. But we didn't know much about bottles.
No, that wasn't what you were looking for. No. What about you, Tony? When you were growing up in Wales, which section of Wales?
Well, I come from North Wales, and I've just remembered the whisky that you did ask for me. It's called Penthrin. Penthrin.
Are there about 50 letters in that word?
Oh, no, but there is a few letters in some of the villages, and we have the second longest name in the world. New Zealand's got the first one. It's got one letter more. And that's Slamvida, Puthquinta, Santa City on Gogogoth. And I've missed out three words out of that as well. So,
is that where you come from?
No, I actually come from about an hour from there. But in North Wales, I come off a mountain. Yes, we didn't have running water, the same as Michael. So we used to get it out of a well. And distributed around the house and also for the cattle. We had a few dams and springs, so there was a lot of natural springs where we are. So basically, not much water, no electricity. So basically we had the paraffin lamps. So that's what they used to use. When I was a little boy, as far as religion, I do remember one story about religion, because I'm a bit of a, I think I'm a Calathumpian in a long ways, because I never got christened. There was a little church down the road, My mother took me down there, and I bolted before the vicar came out and did his words down the fields, and that was the end of that to this day. So, yeah, and that little wooden church is still there today. So, yeah, as far as background goes, same as Michael, brought up with shooting, you know, hunting, growing our own vegetables, growing our own. Meat, as you could say, on the
farm.
Well,
this is the thing. When you're talking about hunting, you're not saying you're just going out to shoot stuff.
No, you're going out to get
food.
That's right.
And it was mainly rabbits, hares. We did have a few grouse around on the mountain. You were limited to what you did shoot. You did shoot in season, and you only shot basically what you're going to eat. Mm. So that was that. We did have sheep because we were a sheep farm. We had a few goats, we had a few pigs, and so we did have a few cattle as well. So we were lucky there was a couple of dairy farms around, so we used to get milk from there. But, yeah, times changed very, very quickly, you know, and you sort of move on. And I lost my father when I was young, so we couldn't stay on the farm, so we moved into the village. We were pretty lucky because my uncles are... live in the village and on a couple of farms, so we're pretty lucky there. As far as it goes, we had a large gathering of cousins that we all stuck together and they all looked after us, so it was, but, you know, happy times. Sort of, Michael will remember, you know, apples always tasted better when you got them from down the road off somebody's tree, growing them yourselves, you know, and gooseberries and all the rest, yeah.
So we had an orchard there with various apple trees, plums, and pears, and plenty of gooseberries. And but there was no shortage of food because I can remember during the war years, my mum and grandmother, they used to give baskets of vegetables away because they... there was a lot of people who had nothing. And then we had the government people coming around because there was a lot of chooks, you know, hens, and that you were allowed so many eggs to keep. They took the eggs away.
The government did?
Oh, yeah, because during the war years, all the farmers had to supply eggs. And then we had to grow... so much silver beet, and that was taken away and turned into fuel, and they brought back the residue, you know, the pulp, to feed the cattle. And we had Italian prisoners of war there when I was about 4 or 5 running around, and I might have been 6, 1938 war, about 44, I was probably 6, and... these guys just worked the farm, and they were all marched to church because they were all Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
They were all marched to church with our farmers with pitchforks. There was 3 German guys there, and they'd been shot down. They were pilots. I can remember as a kid going up to him. This guy was called Rudy. I think he was a captain. And I said, "Do you ever think of running away, escaping?" And he said, "Go away, you silly little boy." But we were, that's the way it was. When we got older, on the fishing side, the tide there, Springford Lock it's called, used to go out for 18 miles, and then the boats, the trawlers were all propped. So they used to scrape the hulls with the barnacles and put the pitch on them again, you know. That was our job. And then when you were older, when you were 14.
Oh, so how old were you when you were doing that job?
Oh, I was probably 8, 9. Old enough to handle the scraper, you know. But you had to do something. And... I can remember all the kids at school during the summer holidays, they're all saying, there was holiday camps in England and Wales and Ireland, Butlin's holiday camps. And these kids were going to there, you know, for the holidays. And they always used to ask, where did you go? I said, oh, I went overseas. But I was up around the Newfoundland banks on the trawlers and chasing the silver darlings, the shoals of herring. And then you had to get into the bath, have about six baths to get the smell of the fish off you with the soap with the little boy on it, the red soap, Lifebuoy. You had to scrub yourself.
Do you know about this, Tony? Do you know about the camps? And the...
Oh, well, not so much the camps because Michael's era is just a little bit, he's a bit older than me. But as far as, you know, just a few points that he's bringing up, fishing, you know, he used to do fishing. I mean, used to do a lot of fishing because we had some beautiful rivers. We had the River Dee, you know, where we are, and I used to go to a place called Llangollen and just fish below that, and another place called Vronkasutli is where they've got the aqueduct, you know, first aqueduct to be built in the world. So these are pretty places, and there's a pool down there. We used to go and stay underneath the aqueduct, so if it did rain, you had a gap of about... 10 meters that you wouldn't get wet, and then we'd fish all night, you know, and get eels and get trout in the day. We used to do a bit of trotting and stuff like that, and then go to the little rivers. So fishing was a big part, as same as going for rabbits. Rabbits was every weekend with my uncles, you know, I'd be in bed early, and then I'd hear them coming down the street from the pub singing. You know, they'd be a bit drunk and carrying on. And then in the morning, I'd be knocking on their door to try and get them up because they said we'd go on at 7 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, especially my Uncle Cedric, and up we'd get, and he'd have the shotgun, and away we'd go with the dogs and a couple of ferrets. And it was a great lifestyle. So we'd go out, the dogs would rustle up a few rabbits and then put them in the burrows, and you'd put your purse nets on the, over the burrow, and they'd come. And yeah, exactly the same with hares. We used to, you know, go and chase a few hares at nights and put some gate nets on and long nets
So you learnt about food from a very basic level there, from actually going and hunting.
Yeah, growing it. You know, I mean, I used to work when I was six, you know, you start work a little bit early, but I used to help my aunties, and they used to work in the fields. They used to pick potatoes. The black used to come around. His name was Colonel Fitchew, and he used to come around. And it was quite interesting. So I'd help them, and you'd have your own little plot with your bags, and you'd fill the bags with the potatoes, and you'd help, and then you'd get some wages at the end of the week. And then I started on the paper round when I was eight, and then I started on the milk round when I was 10. So working wasn't a problem, and then every summer you'd go baling and, you know, helping on the farm and all the rest of it. So
no holidays for you either?
Never had a holiday, and it's quite interesting because he mentioned Butlins, and that was the first holiday that we basically had. We used to have one day, and it used to be with the Salvation Army. Well, it was the Salvation Army. We used to have a bus, and they used to take to the seaside, and we were 1 hour away from the seaside called Rill. So you'd get on this bus, right, and your aunties would be on it, and we'd all go to the seaside for the day to Rill, and then you'd come back. So, and the first holiday we had was basically when I was about 14, and we did go to Butlin's. I was down in Skegness, and that was that was the first and the last holiday. So basically, as a family, we never really had. That was the only holiday we had together. Or the one day, and that was it. And then when I was 15, I was very lucky because I'd saved up a little bit of money, and I basically went on my first holiday was on a school cruise. So it's gone from one extreme to another, you know. But it was all the money I'd saved up. So so that was the holiday side of it until we left school. And
what year did you finish school?
We had to stay on. It was quite. I was in an era when. I don't know when Michael left school, but they used to be 15, and then it went to 16. And then it basically went up to, from 15 to, 16 to 17. And then I was caught on that last year. So in other words, what happened there was we were the oldest in the school for 2 years. So basically it went fully comprehensive then in the UK. Yeah. And then basically what happened, they thought, what are we going to do with this age group? So I think it was a great system where they sent us to what they call it, TAFE in Australia here. So we went 3 days. So one day I went and I was doing bricklaying, and then I was doing basically welding one day. And then I thought, oh, I go into cookery class, you know, this, you get something to eat in there, and you're in. And the class that I was in an all male class in school all the time, and I don't know why, but I thought, oh, you get to go into class with
the girls.
With the girls. And you get something to eat. So, and it was a great system because basically what it did, they followed the curriculum of when you're an apprentice, so the first year. So that's how I learned cookery, and I think that basically got me the job as well, because I'd done the basics for 12 months. So
you'd trained as a chef?
Yeah, so basically I got 3 qualifications, you know, for the day release, you know, from the school qualification, not from the apprenticeship qualification. And I got a qualification as a chef, and basically the basics. So I'd done the basic modules. So when I started off as a chef, I had to basically repeat that year again, but I passed them that year with distinction. So it was, and the other asset of that was, when you go for your job, you've already got knife skills. You've already learned skills, because I spent 12 months basically going to college, as we used to call it, same as TAFE. So you've got some knife skills, and you've got some skills of, you know, poaching, baking, you know, the simple skills. And I think that's an asset when you take on an apprentice, all right, not from scratch.
You've got something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And Mick, you're a stonemason.
Yes, well, I left when I was 16 at school. I'd done probably what they'd call the intermediate certificate here. And I went to TEC, or TAFE, you know, as you call it here. And then my father knew Mr. Murray, and he ran a building, big building, employed everybody, like electricians, carpenters. So I got a job with him, and you still had to go to TAFE 1 day a week and 2 nights a week. You had to do 3 years with the bricklaying and 3 years with the stonemason combined. You know, it was alternative, you were working there. And Murray, well, he taught you, well, the trades guys that was there taught you everything about setting out houses, jobs, reading plans, reading dumpy level. You had to know all that sort of stuff, because in those days, all building sites were ruled or controlled by the bricklayers and stonemasons. Yeah, they were the bosses on the job. When I was 19, I was looking after the work firm on various sites, and he used to let me drive his car. That was only because his daughter, who worked in the office, said, "Tell Dad you're taking me out, mate." And he said, "You and Delaney will be able to." He had a Humber Super Snap. She said, "As long as I'm home on Saturday nights by, you know, 11:30. And I said, "Oh, yeah." So we went just to go to Bangor Drive over there. And there was a boat come in there, like a ferry, and all the English girls used to, you know, they were holidaymakers.
Right.
Bangor was a popular place. We used to float around as if we owned this car. But everybody probably could see through it. Till one day, we're driving up the mountain. We live in a very, very Celtic place. It's called Arda, but Scraba, it was a fort there 5,000 years ago. We're going up Bratchy's Brae, it was called. I'm driving up, and old Murray used to smoke the pipe, and he had his, he always liked his little sip of whiskey where they were going to Belfast or Dublin, where it's sort of 50 miles from each. And he said, Michael, you've been taking Marie out for nigh on 3 months now. They used to speak sort of, you know. I said, yes, Mr. Murray. And he said, yeah. A word of warning, he said. Touch the bra, you're engaged. Touch the pants, you're married. And I nearly crashed the bloody car because I didn't know what she was up to. Monday, I said to her, tell your dad we've split up. She said, he won't believe that. I said, tell him we've split up. And, but it was, as it was, and I was probably almost 21. And there was a big turn, you know, the building, everything went flat. This was 1959. And you couldn't get work anywhere. So all the young blokes, he said, you're going to have to go and find work. He said, he had to keep the older guys, you know, they had old families. So we went to England, Liverpool, got the boat from Belfast to Liverpool, looking for work there. No chance of getting any work. It was the same in England. And we're hunting around, and the money was running out, you know, because in those days there were boarding houses, but the women, the woman that ran it wanted the money up front, you know, there was none of this pay at the weekend sort of thing. So there was Delaney and Brophy and I, and no work, no chance. This guy told, he said, boys, go home. He said, there's no work. And he said, don't go to London. There's no work there either. And there was guys from everywhere, Scotland, Wales, all looking for work. And I saw this sign, join the Royal Marines. Need you. And I'm looking at it. I said to Delaney, what do you think of this? And the money too. It was £12 a week and cap and, you know, everything. I thought, this sounds good. And we went into this recruiting office, and the NCO in there is looking at us. And he said, the whole three of you Irish. I think he was a Geordie, you know, and he's looking at us. And he said, so it's very hard to get into the Marines. I said, what have you got sort of skills? I said, well, I said, I'm a good diver. I can swim. I said, I can use hooker gear, hard helmet. I said, I can rock climb. The boys were the same. I said, I'm a good boxer because I represented Northern Ireland at boxing. He says, okay. Anyway, we were sent away to, you know, a training camp, and in a place called Arbroath in Scotland. And there was about 100 there. The first week, half of them were gone. Couldn't make it. By the end of 16 weeks, there was only 15 of us left. They weeded it right down. But that was only the start of the training.
Were all your mates with you?
Yeah.
So the three of you?
Yeah. They made it through, and then we had to go and train again for a bit of tougher work. And we finished up. I don't know if you can remember, in the 60s, Nasser blocked the canal, Suez Canal. And all British men of war, like cruisers and from up Kerry, Marines, Royal Marines on board, like a land force, you know. So the recon divers were in the water, and the Egyptians on the other bank, the Suez Canal's not real wide, they were lobbing grenades, and the divers, an explosion underwater, the concussion of it, you know, nearly kills you. So my mate Brophy, there was a light machine gun. And he traversed the other side with a machine gun. And Delaney and I got in the water and got the divers out. Anyway, 2 days later, we were called down into the boardroom. And he said, you three have got an invite to try out for 4-5 Commando. I said, we might fail. He said, you'll be back if you fail. Anyway, we never failed.
Wow.
And I was in there for 12 years. Finished up with the SBS. So, and we were all over the world.
So what's the SBS?
The SBS is Special Boat Service. You work out by land, sea, and air. Submarines, everything out of there. You're sneaky people. Anyway, I was in Quebec, and the French, you know, very French-speaking place. And because we had the British uniform, they didn't want to speak to you. No, but the girls wouldn't dance with you or anything like that there. But I heard these girls talk. I said, oh, they're English. But they were Aussies. And they were exchange school teachers over there. And Mary was one of them. So that's how I got to Australia.
Ah, you married an Aussie.
Yeah.
And when did you get here, Tony? Because you've travelled all over the world
yes,
too.
Yes, I did, yeah. So I went to a few countries before. I ended up in New Zealand. So I was over in New Zealand for 15 months. And then I moved from there to Brisbane. And I came there in the end of 1980. And then I started in the largest, it was Lennon's Hotel, was the largest in Queensland at the time. So I was second in charge of that. And basically, yeah, I was there for a while. And then I started opening a few, you know, the cultural centre, Moran's Wharf down the coast. So I thought, well, there's an opening here to open and close, you know, basically hotels, because they wanted 5-star chefs in Queensland at the time. And the money was very, very good, considering. So, yeah, basically started up a business. Used to do old relief, you know, at night. So gather a load of chefs together and we'd go and work in hotels and restaurants. And I used to go up and down, fly up and down in Queensland. So his furthest was Cairns. So I'd go up to Cairns. So if they needed a chef, you know, chefs walked out because that was the big thing them days. They'd need a relief chef before they got a permanent chef. And so we just go and take over and hold the fort for them and then move on. So basically I was opening a place down, Moran's Wharf is in between the Gold Coast and Brisbane, Beenleigh. And that's where I met my wife's there.
And you both end up down here in the Southern Highlands.
Yeah.
It's a bit long-winded, but you...
Well, yeah.
My wife's a double Bayite. I bought an old place at Randwick. And brick and tile, it needed a lot of work. Nobody had lived in it for 10 years. And I got it for $24,000. And I just set about tidying it up, you know, and pulled all the windows out and redid the bathroom and all that. And within 9 months, it was livable, you know, paint. And we were in it for Christmas. I can remember that. Because Mary was pregnant then, and we were in there for Christmas. But he's talking about the Spuds. I can remember when my dad came home after the war, and I'm looking. I hadn't seen him much. He didn't get back to 1947. And he was wanting to buy a tractor. And my old grandfather, there'd be no tractors. He didn't like the tractors too much. He had 14 Clydesdales, and we had 120 acres there, and they ploughed everything. But potatoes, they planted. It was mixed farming, you know, cut the hay, thrashed it. But the Spuds, they buyers from Belfast used to come and Dublin, and they had bought, say, there were long drills, we called them drills, and they'd buy maybe 10 drills. And these women, the taddy hookers, they called them.
Taddy hookers?
Hookers? Taddy hook.
Oh.
And they used to march up and down, and they'd put a stick in, and there would be two women working each side of the drill. Yeah. And they'd put them in a basket, and by the time they got to that, they had bags stacked there on other sticks. And they'd just fill the bags up, and then there'd be a younger woman running along, and she used to come along and stitch the bags up, and they'd put them all in the thing. But they used to dig the Spuds. And, well, I dug them. They used to pick them. But then when they left, my old grandfather, when he saw the versatility of the tractor, because the rest of the stuff was all wheel-driven with the horses, you know, as it went round, we used to set the potato digger, which looked like big fingers, set it deeper, and you got all the little tiny chat spuds, and we used to pick those and bag them. You might have got four or five bags, but that all went to England for the Flash restaurant. So little tiny spuds. And we bred turkeys. They all went to England. We never had a turkey in my life in Ireland. My dad used to, the Canadian geese used to fly over coming up Christmas. They used to shoot the geese. But all the turkeys was big money. And
Tony, did you have the same, you had the same experience with the potatoes, is that right?
Yeah, we had the same potatoes, same shooting background and the same season, but the Canadian geese, we used to use a 10-bore.
Yeah, 10-gauge shotgun.
10-gauge
shotgun. Goose gun.
Yeah, the goose gun. They used to get out, and they'd get it out, you know, two or three times a year, and that'd be about it. And, you know, you didn't really get many as far as it went, but it was, it was great to get one, you know.
Get one.
You know, and it was a great achievement, and I do remember getting them. So that was another thing. And it's, so the same sort of situation. But, you know, to the future, being on the Highlands, you know, we sort of, I came back to Australia with my wife, and we lived in Sydney. And then we basically moved to Wollongong. You know, I came back on the Intercontinental. I worked at Siebel Tennis and run the New South Wales Harness Racing. And then I opened my own restaurant down the south coast. So we decided, you know, I like the countryside. When I was in Wollongong, I had some great times, I met some great people, and started diving, you know, because I love diving. So we used to go for lobsters, and then, you know, then the game fishing started. So that was great. So it was a new era. And then basically I sold the restaurant down the south coast, and I had my eye on the Southern Highlands at the time. So I've always, you know, it was doing the full circle in life, is getting back to the farm. So I thought, well, you know, I've been rewarded for my hard work. So I thought, you know, I'll carry on in my father's footsteps, where, you know, I would have still been there, I suppose. So I thought, I've got to get a farm. So that was my goal. And I ended up on Juwadja Road. And that's where me and Michael sort of come together at the local pub, I suppose. You know, them days, outer barrel was still primitive.
Yeah.
Juwadja was pretty primitive. You know, when I first arrived, I thought, well, that's what I could afford at the end of Juwadja, where it's gone pretty trendy today.
Oh,
the whole lot of it, you know, we used to go to the pub.
The Surveyor General talking about?
Yes, Surveyor General, and they were great days, because they were all farmers that were in there, and that's where they used to get their business from. And all the tradies that come in, like Michael, would get business because people from Sydney started to work out, wow, we can get a farm on the Southern Islands, you know, and we can still live in the city. So this is where the Pitt Street Farmer started. And they all used to like coming into Surveyor, and they'd work out who was the locals. And the locals used to, that's how they used to get their jobs, was through them coming in on Fridays at the Surveyor. So they'd stand there, and
well, that was, I like Kenny Rose, I built his place. And I can remember, Kenny said to me, "Where do you have a beer?" I said, "Down at the Surveyor in Barrymore." He said, "Can I come with you?" I said, "Yeah, certainly you can." Anyway, Ken got in there and got talking to him, and he finished up employing half the guys that went in there, all the young blokes, and Specky. He had the butcher shop in those days, and near where they, I think it would be the bookshop now in Barl. It was a real old-fashioned butcher shop. You went in and saw the, you went in and there was a sort of like a fly trap. You went through one door, and all the sawdust on the floor, and the mother, she was there on the old-fashioned till, you know, it went bang, ding, you know, and cut all the meat there. And there was a lot of young blokes, you know, did their apprenticeship with Spacky.
So I'll have to wrap this up, but I wouldn't mind getting you guys back. It's very interesting to hear what both of you have to say. And now that you've both got a beverage, how's your whiskey there, Tony?
The whiskey's good. It's just mellow. It's got that going through it, you know. It's maybe not the right, you know, I'm a real seasonal sort of bloke. But,
so whiskey in the winter?
Yeah, I do. And I do a bit of trout fishing, so I like, you know, just after trout fishing or in the pub, you know, nice warm whiskey, you know, just to warm you inside up. That's all it does, isn't it, Michael? It just
gives you that.
A whiskey. Gives you a good feeling. Yeah, we might have another chat at the winter. I think even, you know, we've got to the stage, we've got to the pub here, and there is so many good stories that the pub has got to offer. And I think from the point of view of living in the Highlands, as the pub being the hub, it goes back to the village that I come from. We used to have 7 pubs, and that's where all the news was transported from. Everybody goes to the pub, and you know, whether to get jobs or whether to listen to news and all the rest of it.
And the gossip.
And the gossip. And I think.
Is this just an excuse to get my husband to the pub this afternoon?
No, I don't. You feel part of a. You've got to relax. You know, this day and age is full of tense people, and I think, you know, you either go out shooting, or you go out fishing, you go out walking, it doesn't have to be anything, you know, you go on the beach, you go swimming, whatever, but you still got to have a group of people that you can sort of basically talk to and relax with, and in an ambience, you know, it's all about ambience as well.
Well, I was just going to say, because neither of you are massive drinkers, I mean, you're not... You don't stagger out of the pub. You're there for the community, for
that communal gathering. Yeah,
and
we've got a lot of stories about the pub with the communal gathering, because it used to be all about communal gathering, you know, the Berrimah pub. You know, it lost its way a few times, but it'd be great to sort of see it come back in its way.
All right. So. Okay. You boys are coming back to the downhill slide to talk about the Surveyor General Inn, okay? Thank you both for
Ross
your time today.
Very general.
So am I invited now?
That's my husband, Paul. Yes, maybe you're invited. Thank you both.
Yeah, lovely. Thank you.
No problem.
What I found fascinating about the conversation, yeah, it was interesting to hear about these guys growing up with no electricity and having to hunt on the land for their food, dig up potatoes and such. The end of the conversation, talking about the pub. When I grew up, you went to the pub to get plastered. That was it. It was to get drunk and, you know, find a nice bloke. I don't know about nice, but anyway. They went to the pub. They knew the pub. As they grew up, it was the place for, yeah, entertainment, but catching up with people. That's really what it was about. And here in Australia, I feel like we need that change, that when we go to an entertainment venue, we're going there for that purpose, not to obliterate ourselves with alcohol or drugs, which is, yeah, when I grew up in the 70s and 80s, that just excess, that's what it was all about. And now we've made a return, and I think it's a good thing. We need to think about people. With everything that's going on in the world, we need to communicate more. We need more togetherness, and less inebriation, I think. We'll all be the better for it. Thanks for listening.